This is the official EFL podcast with Mark Clement.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of a four-part mini-series of the official EFL podcast with me, Mark Clement, where EFL department leads provide a unique insight into the workings of the organisation and explain some of the key roles and functions of the world's original league competition. What is it the Football League does? How do they do it? And why? Inside the walls of the EFL on this mini-series edition of the official EFL podcast. And in this episode, we're going to talk about youth development and also about safeguarding. Dave Wetherill is the EFL's head of the former and Alex Richards, the head of the latter. And yes, before you ask, Dave Wetherill is, of course, the former Leeds and Bradford City defender. Do you know what I think we'll do with this? There's two obvious separate subjects here, but you kind of overlap a bit. So I think we'll concentrate youth development at first, if that's okay with you, Alex. Then we'll do safeguarding as the second tranche, but do feel free to sort of jump into each other's sections, if that's okay. Do you know what would be useful, though, to kick us off? Dave, do you want to give us a little insight into the EFL's youth development system and what it is that you personally actually do, please?
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm a youth development director at the EFL, so I head up a team of regional managers who support the EFL clubs who operate academies, essentially. The operation of academies is not mandatory in the EFL. It's up to the clubs whether they participate in the system. There's some central funding provided that then the clubs need to provide further investment to. So it's a club decision as to whether they have an academy or not. Going into next season, it looks like we'll probably have 68 of our 72 clubs operating academies. So most clubs do engage in the system. And in terms of the academy system, there's four categories of academy that clubs can be, essentially. Category four is a late development model, so that operates from under 17s and older. The category one to threes operate from under nines upwards. That's when players can be registered. The category one models, if you like, the highest level of academy, which has the largest budgets and the most staff, etc. The standards in the academy system are helped to be maintained. We've got an independent audit company who's fairly recently, just in the last couple of years, been established. That's a professional game academy audit company. And they make sure that academies abide by the rules and further drive the standards. So it's a reasonably complex picture, I suppose. And it certainly keeps me out of mischief looking after my part of the system. You know, we work really closely with the Premier League as well, I should say, because this is not a league-specific system. We work in the same system as the Premier League as well.
I mean, it's interesting that it's not compulsory, and you've kind of outlined next season it'll be 68 out of the 72, because it strikes me that it's ever-changing sands for you, because every season you will lose and gain five members, i.e. three going up to the Premier League, two coming up from the National League. And you've got a really kind of separate range of clubs as well there, Dave, haven't you? From those followed by 1,800 towards the bottom end of League Two to those that'll have tens of thousands in the Championship. So I'm guessing there's lots of different requirements in terms of liaising with them and helping them.
Yeah, I think it's one of the challenges for anybody working within the EFL, I suppose, is the range of clubs that you deal with. You know, as you said, some of the biggest clubs in the country, and then, you know, some of the smaller professional outfits. I suppose it's a real range, and that's the case in the academy system as well. But yeah, we do have the challenge of clubs coming into the EFL from the Premier League and going the other way to the Premier League. And as I said, that's one area that we work really closely with the Premier League at. Our regional managers who look after the clubs, the Premier League have an equivalent club support mechanism, essentially. So we engage with their staff to get a good understanding of where the clubs are when they go up and come down. And in and out of the National League, there's effectively a two-season parachute for clubs when they go down to the National League. Gives clubs an opportunity to continue operating academy within the EFL-PL system, if you like. And then after that time, they may gravitate towards the National League academy system. But, you know, when clubs come out of the National League, as we've had this year with Sutton, we're working with them really closely at the present time to, you know, see if they can get into the system for next season.
And Alex, if we're talking about safeguarding, I mean, I mentioned the dovetail because obviously when we're talking about academy football, we've got lots of, you know, children, young adults that are going through these teams and year groups, et cetera, et cetera. Do you want to give us a little oversight as to your role and the EFL's own safeguarding regime? And probably just for the benefit of those that hear this phrase, safeguarding, and it's been one of those eras when we put the 10 o'clock news on and it comes up a lot. But do you want to just give us a definition as well so we're all clear exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about safeguarding, please?
Yeah, no problem. So my role's safeguarding manager for the EFL. I know Dave had a bit of a illustrious introduction with his footballing career. I think I was a egg and spoon race champion about three times at primary school. But apart from that,
let me just make it clear: all sport is honourable. It's all good. We're all equal on this podcast, Alex. Okay. But I notice he didn't brag about his career like you just did with getting that egg over the line. Please continue.
So, my role is safeguarding, the strategic oversight of safeguarding within all our 72 clubs, member clubs. And safeguarding, I think I encompass it by saying a lot of people think about child protection in terms of concerns around adults' behaviour towards children, and that is child protection, whereas safeguarding really goes much wider than that in terms of what we do with our young players and young adults. It's really around their welfare, you know, the player care and everything that encompasses when they spend time with us through the academy system.
So it's not just obvious things, it is making sure there is a full welfare programme in place so that everybody's nurtured with regards to mental health, with regards to potential transition out of the game. You're involved in the full composite package, and that's where you will work closely, I'm guessing, with Dave.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we want young people to come out of this experience enriched. You know, not everybody will make it as a professional footballer, but that doesn't mean that this experience can't be a great opportunity for them to take on to a pathway to other careers. And that's what we really focus on. And to ensure that, you have to have that package of support around them, like you say, in terms of mental health, in terms of career planning, in terms of player care. You know, if young people get injured, we want to help them back on the road to being able to play again. So, it encompasses a huge package of support that our academies give to young people.
That's our setup. Right. Jump in, Alex, if you want to, because I want to talk to Dave about some aspects of what he does. I mean, just how significant has the whole EPPP system been with regards to the EFL? I better just explain that as well for anybody that keeps hearing these alphas. It's the Elite Player Performance Plan. Do you want to give a little bit of a potted history on the actual plan itself, Dave, and then how it's affected what you do?
Yeah, I can do. As you say, Elite Player Performance Plan, the rules for that came in to operation in July 2012. They were in discussions. I started this role in July 2011, so I was involved in, the tail end of discussions to shape that system, I suppose. And if I had to sum up the way that it's actually changed youth development in our academies, I would say it's changed it dramatically. And it's changed in terms of organisation and structure across all clubs. So it's made sure essentially that as a baseline, every club has fundamental elements in place. So really basic and simple things first and foremost, like a playing philosophy. So how does a club's first team play? And how does that change coming down from through the 18s, the 16s, the 14s, the 12s and the 10s across the age groups? How does that change? And also things like the coaching philosophy. How you coach a 23-year-old is very different to how you coach a 9-year-old. So making sure that all clubs have that and have thought about their own club-specific philosophies. Every club then needs to have in place things like a transition plan. How are they going to transition players out of their academy into their first-team environment? And where does the academy sit in the club? So things like something called a technical board meeting's being established, which requires senior club involvement, chief exec, first team manager, but also academy staff. So it's an opportunity to really talk about progression of academy players and how things are going in the academy and how that can influence an impact at first team and club level. I think one of the big changes being age specificity, just recognising that things are different for 9-year-olds as they are to older age groups. And the FA have had a role here about the coaching qualifications that are delivered. You know, we've now got age-specific coaching awards, such as the Advanced Youth Award, in place. And, you know, in that area and also in how academies operate, there's been a huge shift in the perceptions of English football across this period. You know, the clubs and associations on the continent used to look at us and not many people came over to find out how we were doing things in this country. That's changed. You know, our reputation in terms of quality of our young players and our coaches as well, I think, is changing. But certainly in terms of the quality of our young players, we're regarded on the continent as having, you know, outstanding talent in this country now. And that's something that has changed under the Elite Player Performance Plan. And obviously, we're looking forward to that continuing on and into the future. I think one other area I would just mention on the back of what Alex was saying is the area of player care, a real focus of the Elite Player Performance Plan through areas such as education and life skills programme provision and things such as exit strategies for players, as well as the area of safeguarding.
I mean, that in itself is a really interesting area, isn't it, that we were touching on with Alex there. And I know you are quite scholarly in your own playing career. You were the man who famously missed the bus tour with Leeds United to celebrate the Premier League win, weren't you? Because you were revising for your own... Was it for your own degree you were trying to complete at that time?
That's it, yeah. I'm never quite sure whether that was the right move, Clem. I've got to be honest.
Mate, I'm not into... You probably thought they were going to come along every 2 minutes, did you, and things? Because you'd played, let's be honest, Dave, such a bristling part in Leeds' title-winning success that season. Those 2 minutes were very valuable, mate, weren't they?
Made all the difference.
Good.
Yep.
But, serious question, do you think the fact that somebody is heading the EFL's Youth Development Department who has put such an importance on qualifications and life away from football has also helped you to shape those young minds and to pass your own personal experiences on? Because you know what a lot of elite coaches are like, and they might be saying, well, wait a minute, every vestige, every second has got to be concentrated on trying to make it as a footballer. Why do you need a backup plan? Or am I being old-fashioned with that view?
No, I think... From a personal point of view, I'd like to think I played my part in it. But I think, you know, right across the system, I think there's been a recognition, if we've just focused on education, how important that is. And as Alex said, there's only a very limited number of players who are going to go through the academy system and make a prolonged career from playing the game. And even players that do, they're going to come out, and the vast majority of those are going to need a second career. So education's absolutely fundamental. And the fact that a player is engaged in an academy should not impact detrimentally on a player's education. There's no reason for it to do that. And the provisions that we have in place now, you hear some of the stories from pre-Treble P about where things might not have been so positive. But now... We have a system in place where clubs have to liaise with the schools of every player that's engaged in the academy system just to check that their involvement in the academy system is not impacting detrimentally on their educational progression. And where players, young people, sorry, miss any of the normal school day to come into the academy and play football, then there's a very significant additional raft of things that clubs need to put in place. They need to provide... additional education support, they need to provide compensatory education sessions, and they need to actually track educational progression of the players to ensure that there is no detrimental impact to engaging with the club. So, you know, that typically happens at 9s to 16s, and then once we get into the scholarship age groups, this is where the programme, which is age 16 to 18, the programme has a very, very significant education focus as well. That's where players become full-time, if you like, as footballers. But on top of that, they're taking qualifications, typically a BTEC level qualification. But if a player is academically able, they're able to take A-levels as well now. So there is, even where a player doesn't take A-levels, the BTEC can get players into university if they don't have the offer of a professional contract at the end of it. So education is a real focus, I think, for the young people within the academy system now. And you know, we're really, really hopeful and optimistic that players coming in, the young people coming into the system, there's no reason why engagement in the academy system should impact negatively on their educational progression.
Yeah, the latest stats I have that 45% of EFL scholars go on to gain some sort of professional contract, but that obviously means that the rest don't and need to be prepared for the world outside. Does that mean you get involved at that level, Alex? Would you be liaising, sort of, perhaps there'll be a list of players who are in, the say, their final year who look as though they may not be taken on, and you'll be encouraging them even more? Would that dovetail into your department?
Well, we have our partners, League Football Education, who work with young people, particularly around, like I say, progression and careers and transition out of clubs. So they will be, even when young people sign up, they already need to be thinking about, well, what are my other pathways? What are my other interests? What could I do with this scholarship that I get if I don't become a professional footballer, and start looking at those options? And we have young people who go abroad and take different opportunities, working abroad in sport, going to university and doing physiotherapy. So there's a lot of opportunity. I think it's really important that young people don't forget their identity when they come into an academy. They are very good at football, and football is an option for them, but it's not the only thing. You know, we have a lot of young people who come in and they're really good in other areas of their lives, in terms of music, or have different hobbies and interests. And I want to encourage academies to say, let's look holistically at the young person and remember that they, if they don't make it, they still have lots of other great opportunities ahead of them.
Well, that's one size fits all, isn't it? But I mean, I'm guessing you're dealing with cliff top drama as well at times, which is that those that do find themselves released, and some will take it harder than others, some will be more prepared and have had an inkling that they're not going to make it as a professional. And I guess that's when you earn your stripes too. And I love the fact you've got this tracking program, or certainly League Football Education has, that sort of tracks where released players go for the 3 years after they have been released.
Yeah, it's really important that, you know, we keep in contact and the club keeps in contact with those young people. You know, we have success stories, and not every success story is just a young person going into the first team. There's lots of other people that go into the industry that, you know, that are really successful and make a really valid contribution as well.
So those are the ones that don't make it, David, but obviously there's so many wonderful stories around at the moment. We've only got to look at England's squad in the Euros, of players nurtured at EFL clubs, given opportunities, brushed up, moved on, or, you know, have come out of the EFL's competitions, played in the three divisions, played in the trophy, played in the League Cup.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories around the England squad, and that's obviously been a focus with the Euros on at the present time. Lots of stories of players who play regularly in the Premier League as well, who have, you know, come through EFL academies or developed themselves within the EFL. And I think you know, a lot of people talk about the pyramid that we have in this country, and how countries abroad look at us and wonder how we can sustain this many professional football clubs. But we think it's a fantastic culture in this country, how we have this pyramid, and that exists in youth development as well. That, you know, players develop at different rates and go through different pathways to get to their end point. It's not the same for every player. They look at things differently, and different things suit the player. Some players will go on loan, for example, and a number of loans, and develop through those experiences. Some other players will come through directly at their parent club. Other players will get developed, as we said, in, you know, a League Two club, for example, and then maybe get a couple of professional moves and end up at the top end of the Premier League. And there are so many stories around how you know, EFL and EFL academies and the clubs in general have provided opportunities for these players to take those steps towards the very top end of the game.
Let's drill down into a couple of those themes. You mentioned loans there. I mean, just how beneficial is the loan system to the EFL pyramid?
I think there's a number of aspects to consider around the loan system. From a youth development, player development perspective, loans can provide those key learning developmental experiences in games that really matter. You know, those games on a Saturday afternoon in front of crowds where the media's got a real focus on it. And that's an environment that can really stretch and test players and provide those experiences that maybe, you know, the academy environment can't quite do to that extent. And also the loans can obviously provide a quality of opposition that's a step up from what players are used to. So it's really beneficial from a youth development perspective. From a first team perspective, loans can you know, freshen up a squad without a prolonged financial commitment, if you like, from our clubs. And obviously there's a lot of our clubs that haven't got a lot of money sloshing about in the club, so that can be a real benefit. I mean, from a youth development perspective, I always feel we need to maintain a balance from loans to ensure that a huge number of loans coming into a club doesn't block the opportunities for the young players coming through at that club. So I think there's a lot of aspects to consider when we talk about the loan system and the benefits thereof.
And the other side of this is the homegrown player regulation. Do you want to just explain that for anybody who's maybe enjoyed the benefits but has lost touch with exactly what's written into EFL regulations?
Yeah, we have a couple of regulations around this. One of them is homegrown players, which is players who've essentially been in the system for 3 years before they're age 21. And we have a minimum of 7 homegrown players on the team sheet. I think last season we had an average of 15 homegrown players on each team sheet. So we're way in excess of the minimums there. Another regulation, which is absolutely closer linked to the academy environment, is the club developed player criteria that we have. So a club developed player has been in a club for at least 12 months prior to the end of the under-19s year. So that is essentially an academy developed player in virtually all instances. And clubs need to select a club developed player either on their team sheet for each match or in their squad list. And what this does, it cements a definitive pathway from our academies to our first teams. So the young people in our academies can see the players in a first team environment that have taken a similar journey to what they're hoping to do, and it can help join the club up and join the whole pathway up straight through from the academies into the first team, and provide those opportunities. Every young player needs that opportunity to if they're going to establish themselves in the first team environment, and this provision can help to do that.
Yeah, and obviously there's other aspects as well, isn't there, which is it can create that bond. There's nothing fans love more than a homegrown player being given up an opportunity, but sometimes you've got to do that consistently over half a season for them to really find their feet and not just be a fleeting substitute appearance.
Exactly. This can be a real positive for clubs from bringing their own players through in terms of the interaction with their supporters. You say fans generally love to see that. I think developing your own young players as well can possibly provide a competitive advantage over other clubs if the players are of sufficient quality. And also another, if you're developing really, really strong young professionals in your club, they have a significant value. And, you know, development of young players in the EFL, we shouldn't hide away from the fact it's not a philanthropic exercise by club owners, you know, and the finances of this do come into play. And, you know, if you get young players who are performing at a level in the first team environment where they're attracting interest from big clubs, then it can result in significant financial benefits.
I mean, as well, if you look at it, there are some really successful clubs with a kind of player trading model in place. I'm thinking of the Brentfords, I'm thinking of the Peterboroughs, who kind of brush up and move on and seem to know where the next one is to go through the same process with. And it doesn't seem to stem their success on the field to be moving players on to sustain the club off the field.
Yeah, and there's a lot of examples where, you know, players being developed in a club environment who might be in League Two, for example. Just springing to mind now is a couple of Ollies, Ollie Watkins and Ollie McBurney. Ollie Watkins was at Exeter, came through the youth development system there, moved on to Brentford and then gone on to play for Aston Villa. And Exeter have benefited substantially from those moves. Similarly with Ollie McBurney, who was in the youth system at Bradford, went to Swansea, then moved for big money into the Premier League with Sheffield United at the time. So Exeter and Bradford have benefited financially from the work to develop those players that they've put in over time.
Couple of other things I want to drill down with you on, Dave. The importance of the Carabao Cup and Papa John's Trophy. Why are these competitions specifically so important, do we feel?
From a youth development perspective, I would come back to a word I used a little while ago, opportunity. In these competitions, in a first team sense, there's an increased use probably of squad players and young players, which provides that often that chance for these young players to impress and stake a claim to be in the first team more regularly. And I think that's extremely important from the Papa John's perspective. Obviously, we've got the under 21s team who participate in that competition, and from an academy perspective, that's extremely highly regarded because it provides that unique opportunity for these under 21 players who are at some of the biggest clubs in the country to play against senior professionals. And that's been deemed to be hugely beneficial in the development pathways of those young players involved.
It's been a huge challenge for the whole world over the past 16, 17 months. How has the pandemic affected academies and youth development across the EFL?
It's been really challenging, obviously. There's been periods where the clubs have only been able to have limited contact with the young people in their academies, and where they have been able to operate, they've had to operate under really demanding protocols. In these periods of limited contact, sometimes it's been a case of remote and video training sessions. You know, one-on-one training sessions with young lads having a football in the back garden. But also, it's been really important, and the clubs have done this really well, I think, in keeping in touch with players. I know some clubs have had quiz nights, etc. Just maintaining that social contact, if you like, with the young people. There's been prolonged periods where, even when players have been able to come into the club, it's not felt like normal. It's just been no indoor areas, just no changing rooms, for example. So people getting changed outside in the rain, if you like. But we're just trying to make the best of it. And I think in general, the strict protocols and adherence to the strict protocols and how difficult a period it's been, the clubs have really been outstanding in my view, in the work that they've put in this time to maintain some element of contact with the players in a safe environment.
Challenging from your point of view, Alex?
Yeah, I think, as Dave said, it's difficult when the young people aren't around and aren't in the club. So you feel that you don't have their eyes on with them. Just keeping in contact with them, you know, over Zoom or doing different things makes it challenging. But the clubs have really risen to that challenge. And as Dave said, some innovative ways of actually engaging with the young people. We've heard of cooking classes going on to make sure that they're still, you know, eating really well and keeping, and we know for mental health, you know, making sure that young people aren't spending too much time gaming, are sleeping well, they're keeping up with their diet, and all those things just help get through a really challenging period like the COVID lockdown.
Yeah, but also by the same token, sometimes with regard, I'm guessing, to safeguarding, it's the stuff that isn't said, it's those small little telltale signs, it's looking in the gaps for where there might be an issue that needs to be explored. I guess it's been hard from that point of view, just to keep an eye on everybody in all walks of life.
It has. I think that's true, you know, in out of the sporting world as well. But I think what we've done, we've used that time to spend training our safeguarding officers, and training and vigilance in terms of safeguarding is really the key, because like you say, it's the things that aren't obvious. It's the things in between the lines. It's, you know, not everybody discloses when they're struggling with their mental health, but sometimes you can just pick up on signs that actually somebody isn't going through a very good time. So we've done loads and loads of training with our safeguarding officers in clubs via Zoom to upskill them so that they know actually maybe that is a sign that this young person isn't doing too well, and actually these are the kind of conversations I can have with them to make sure that we can get the right support at the right time.
Alex, do you just want to explain to us how your safeguarding team interact with the other governing bodies, obviously the FA? Who has the overall responsibility?
Yeah, well, it's really important that all stakeholders work together across football. So like you say, the FA, you know, the Premier League, ourselves, we have our set of safeguarding standards, rules and regulations. And in terms of our member clubs, we govern that.
Who sets those rules and regulations, Alex? How are they formed and how often do they change, get refreshed?
Every season, and we do them in consultation with our clubs. We look at good practice and statutory guidance from outside of the sporting world, within the sporting world, and make sure that, you know, we're putting everything that's relevant and needed into those safeguarding standards. We set them every season. They are set by the EFL board, but we work very closely with the Premier League and the FA and align with their regulations and their standards that they have, because we don't want to have a different set of hoops, particularly for, say, our clubs that get relegated or promoted. And we know we have some that happens each season for them. We don't want them to have to be getting used to a new set of rules or regulations because they're in a different league. But it's really important as well that in football, and we've learned some lessons in terms of this, that we have the same rules and regulations so that we don't have perpetrators and people that move around the game. You know, we all need to be vigilant and having the same strict regulations in place to make the whole footballing family, you know, a safe environment for all young people, and not just, you know, professional football having a particularly, you know, high set of standards. It needs to be stakeholders working together.
It's only a shortish podcast, so we can't obviously go through line by line. But can you give us some of the measures that are in place to make sure that academies are a safe environment?
Yeah, well, there's things, you know, looking, like I've mentioned, about, you know, people working within the game. We need to make sure that we're safer recruiting people. That's what we call it. So that everybody who comes in to work in our clubs goes through a strict recruitment process. We have standards around, we've mentioned it earlier, mental health and player care. You know, we know that in young people in society, not just within football, mental health concerns are on the increase. So we have standards around mental health and provision and the training of staff within our clubs on mental health and player care. We have standards in terms of policies and procedures and staff training so that everybody understands what their obligations are if they work for that club on safeguarding, and everybody understands what they need to do if they have a concern around a young person or anybody working within the club. So the standards are, like you say, we don't want to go through it line by line. It's quite a big document, but it covers all the aspects that we feel we really need in place to make it a real child safe environment.
I think we should stress as well that you've got representation at board level with regard, you know, there's obviously a nominated head at board level with regard to safeguarding. There's structures in place at all clubs. I guess people will want to know as well what auditing and checking mechanisms are in place.
Yeah, so we have audit of our clubs. It's an independent audit, so it's done by a leading children's charity. So they go out and they look at the club's work against those standards, and they rate the clubs against those standards. So, you know, it really gives us that independent scrutiny. It's not the league itself kind of marking its own homework in respect of its clubs. It's safeguarding professionals who've worked in the safeguarding world for many years, looking at the work of all of our clubs.
I know you've been with the EFL since 2018. I mean, we also know that you're a dab hand at egg and spoon races. I don't know what your own background was or how much football knowledge you had before then, but how have things improved in the last few years, and what have been the sort of catalysts for that?
Yeah, I mean, it was an interesting time in 2018 to join football. My background was education. I was an assistant principal at a college, so it was a large college of 16 to 18 year olds. So safeguarding, of course, was my bag. Football was new to me, but safeguarding, you know, is, I think, the same in any organisation, and, you know, needs to be a child-centred approach. And I think particularly because of 2016 and we'd had the non-recent abuse allegations in football. Coming in 2018 was a real catalyst for change. And, you know, the EFL and the board of the EFL were really supportive in terms of having a complete fresh look at safeguarding and the work of our clubs and the scrutiny that we had of that work and making sure that we were as vigilant and as compliant as we could be in all of those areas to make football a really safe environment.
I'm guessing that's had an enormous impact on your side of things, Dave. Your youth development has changed no end in terms of the regulation of people and making sure there are those extra layers of protection in there for the young players.
Yeah, exactly. I think it comes from an academy player development perspective. I think Alex touched on it earlier that, you know, moving forwards, I think whilst we obviously want to continue to build on the progress under the Elite Player Performance Plan and what we've seen over the last 10 years, we want to do that with this continued focus on player care to ensure that it's not just the players who make it through the system and become professionals that have a positive experience, but it becomes a positive experience for everybody within the academy system, whether they're in that system for, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years or for 1 year. So it's just, you know, there's a focus on welfare, I think, in the modern society, and that's how it impacts, if you like, on what we're doing in the youth development system.
Alex, what are the biggest challenges that you face right now in your role and your department faces going forward? What's going to happen over the next 12 months?
Post-COVID, it's going to be interesting, but I think, again, that's true for, you know, a lot of organisations, but just coming back after, you know, a great deal of time out of academy football. And we know, you know, organisations are already saying of the effect that the lockdown has had on young people in terms of their mental health, in terms of loneliness and anxiety. So that's going to be a challenge. I think in terms of young people, the challenge is always online environments. There's always a concern that perpetrators now move to online environments to groom and get access to young people, so that we're educating young people about the risks involved in being online. We know what the risks are because they're constantly changing in an online environment. That will always be a big challenge. And we've touched on it quite a few times now, mental health and the concerns around mental health for young people. We know that there are more and more young people reporting mental health issues and services in terms of, medical and waiting lists in terms of NHS. That's very difficult to get them access to the support. And sometimes for our clubs, it means that we have to try and provide that interim support to keep those young people as well as can be while they might be struggling.
We having to counsel young players as well. I'm just combining the two parts there, Alex. We having to counsel young players about the use of social media, not just in terms of what they might put out themselves, but in terms of the whole abuse that is lying out there. I think there's probably a whole era of young players that one of the first things they do these days is not ring their dad sitting in the crowd, but check social media to see what comments have been made about them. If they've had a good game, that could be positive affirmation. If they've done something that doesn't suit a tranche of support, that could be a very negative factor that could have a detrimental effect on their mental health.
Yeah, League Football Education, again, do a lot of work about online environments with our players. And that can be, like you say, from making sure that they don't put themselves at risk in terms of the sites and things that they're going to. But I always think with football, it's the same issues that, you know, other 16-year-olds or other young people can have. It's just exemplified by the fact that you may have lots more followers at a very young age. And for them, like you say, the criticism that they get is just, it tends to be a bit more often, or it tends to be a bit more personal in terms of their football and playing career. And we need to support those young people. And that's why the player care is so important, because some of these things these young people face are quite unique to the industry and the environment that they find themselves in.
Dave, I hope we've done justice to the work you've done over the last decade. How does the future look for you? What would you like to see happen? Certainly over the next 12 months, but if we're looking that bit further ahead, let me give you another half decade. What would you like to see happen? Where do you want us to go?
I think over the next few months, then it's returning. I'm sure that the whole country would echo this, returning to something more like normal. And you know, with a focus on the specifics of academy operations within EFL clubs, getting back to be able to operate something like normal, using indoor areas with you know, as much activity as we've had in previous seasons without the huge shadow of COVID hanging over us. I think over the next few years, I'd refer you back really to what I said a few minutes ago. I think we need to continue to build on, in terms of developing players, the progress under the Elite Player Performance Plan, and continue each year to review where we are and how we can improve things in terms of the quality and number of players we deliver, but also do that with this, you know, continued focus on the care of the young people who attend academies. With the aim of trying to ensure that operating coming to academies is a positive experience for all the young people who do so, and not just for the ones who get a successful outcome, if you like, through achieving a professional contract or a career as a professional.
And when we see the very high profile flow through of people that have graduated from EFL clubs, have used EFL competitions to advance their career, that can only be a positive affirmation going forward, can't it? There is a clear pathway there for the next generation to identify with.
I think from a player development perspective, yes, that's an obvious sign of success of the work that, you know, I'm sure that the other members of the EFL Youth Development Department would agree with me is, you know, not down to us. It's down to the work of the individuals within the clubs and the hard work that they are doing to work with these young people and develop them as players. And obviously, we hope that there's a continued progression of players from within EFL academies to the very top of the game. I think we shouldn't have that as the expectation, but it's obviously a really positive sign of the work that's going on in EFL academies if that occurs.
Final question, Dave. Shall we leave Alex to have the top sporting accolade on this special edition of the EFL podcast with her success in the Egg and Spoon race? Or shall we just say goal that kept Bradford City in the Premier League and then you can walk away with a gold medal? The choice is yours.
I'll give it Alex. At least she won something.
I'm going to call it a draw. Well done to both. Thank you very much for explaining, for demystifying. Thank you very much for taking us into some of the detail. Keep up the great work. Great to talk to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of the official EFL podcast, looking at some of the inner workings of the EFL, its role, its functions, and its responsibilities. Thanks to Head of Youth Development, David Wetherill, and Head of Safeguarding, Alex Richards. Watch out for other episodes when we'll continue our unique insight into the key functions of the organisation. Until then, I'm Mark Clement. Thanks for listening to this mini-series edition of
the official EFL podcast.